Thanks, June. That's great. You know, there's you make me think that there are these moments that I recall with such clarity, where someone was a kind or nice or encouraging, that I look back and I realize for them it was a passing moment. I mean, it wasn't. I remember so clearly when I picked up a 6-month chip. Surprisingly enough, at 6 months sober, those coincided, and I was leaving the little clubhouse here in Nashville called 202, and the meetings are upstairs, and I'm walking down the stairs after the meeting, and I felt a tap on my shoulder, and I turned around. It was this woman that I knew. I mean, I didn't know her. We didn't talk. I didn't have a relationship with her. She actually was a bit of a celebrity around town here. And so I knew of her, and I loved her when she was in the meeting. I loved listening to her share, but I had never spoken to her. We're going down those stairs. I felt that tap on my shoulder, and I turned around, and she's just walking by, and she said, "You're doing good, Steve," and went on by. And what I'm telling you today is I can see that like it's a photograph. And I can see her hair. I can smell her perfume. That is a moment frozen in time. And it pains me to think how often I blow by those opportunities with other people. And that these things that just last. And I've got people that, you know, June has such wonderful stories to share with the people that were a part of her recovery and people that were that. In our community are Mount Rushmore quality people in our community. But you know what? We all have those people in our meeting. We all have those people when we were new. And when you talk of that provided unknowingly, and it's not the title I would have put on it till right now, that provided emotional sobriety for me in the moment. That walked in the meeting and I felt better because they were there. That person that I didn't know well, but that I just, they're, you know, as our book says, their comportment screened that they were sober members of that. You know what? They knew something I didn't know. They knew everything was going to be okay. And even more than that, they knew everything already was okay. And you could feel it. And what I, some of you folks on here will know Don Pritz, that passed away now about 13, 14 years ago, I think. And my wife and I went to a retreat that Don led, and it was a small little retreat. And at the end of the weekend, he was saying goodbye, and he was one of the really special guys in for me as well. But I didn't know him well. And Connie didn't know him at all before that weekend. And when he looked at her and thanked her for being there that weekend and had that 30-second conversation that we have with people, he was right there with her. And we got in the car, headed home, and we were talking, and she began to weep. And she said, "There's something about that man." And we talked about it a little bit, and what we decided was it wasn't about the man. It was that the man was such a channel, that it was about the spirit. It was about the divine spark in the man that he was so out of the way of that it spilled out onto us. And that's what men and women in AA have done for me. And I think that I'm not like June. I aspire to be like June. Trust me. She's a standard bearer in Alcoholics Anonymous for a guy like me. But as she was talking self-deprecatingly about maybe getting a little irritated if one of Mark's sponsees calls tonight, how often someone has offered me, has stood in front of me asking for help, and I'll glance at the clock, or I will do something that implies my time is up. And there are people who have stood in front of me in Alcoholics Anonymous that never did it feel like their time was up with me. Their availability seemed to be there. And anyway, I don't know why I went down that rabbit hole, but that's, you know, that's what, but that's kind of what we're trying to show up for, right? For each other. And we are so fortunate. We are so fortunate that either alcohol or our alcoholic or life conditions drove us together into a community that ever haltingly is trying to stumble forward and find a way to be more useful, more helpful, more connected to the people in our lives. I want to go back to the topic. But as I've often said, you know, AA's, you Al-Anons are probably more effective in your workshops. I know Stephanie was right on point. AA's just don't ever seem to be held hostage to the topic. We just can't contain ourselves. But what I've discovered is that, you know, and Bill talks about that when you peel everything else away in that essay, that it was these faulty dependencies. The question, Yaman had asked me to address the question or comment that Liz had had and was saying at 22 years sober that she, and I think she had to get off here. By the way, Yaman made note that many of our European friends had to get off because it's so late there. That's weak. You gotta stay up, you gotta fight through it, you know. At 1, 2 o'clock, come on, be a player. But that these faulty dependencies on people, places, and things, on whatever. And I don't know, I don't understand that I am dependent. One of the lines in the 12 and 12 that has been so useful to me, informative. I'm about to make a difference in a minute between informative and transformative. Those are different things. But I'm more informed than I've ever been. And it says that we will see that we have been making unreasonable demands upon others, upon God, and upon ourselves. And if you're keeping score, that's everybody. There's nobody, you know, that's everybody. There's nobody left to be disappointed in. I'm disappointed in you. I'm disappointed in God. I'm disappointed in me. You're all letting me down. And the key word in that, I guess, is I will see, I will awaken, spiritually awaken to the fact that I've been making unreasonable demands. And see, I've been operating on the basis that these are reasonable demands. Because it seems so clear to me, my sponsor that I've mentioned a few times, Don's mantra, if he had a mantra, it would be, God help me love, comfort, and understand rather than demand to be loved, comforted, and understood. That excerpt from the St. Francis Prayer. I tend to judge people. And another Cliff Roach line, Cliff said, and we say in AA, we don't judge people. Cliff said, we judge, but we don't condemn. And, you know, we make assessments and, but I got to decide whether to let you in my house or not, whether to introduce you to my family or not, whether loaning you that $5 is helpful or not. So we're making assessments, but we don't condemn. And I love that distinction. But to recognize that my demands have been unreasonable. That I need so much from you. And I realize that in so many of my relationships that I have defined particular relationships based on our worst moment together. And then I put you in jail for that egregious transgression. And there seems to be no statute of limitations. That I keep you in this box. And again, I'm not thinking about it. That just becomes the lens through which I see certain people from. It's been about 2 years ago now, Connie and I were going to, we're big Vanderbilt basketball fans. So I'd had one of those days, and I don't want to be immodest, but I've had one of those days where it's like I had a superpower, man. I'd gone around, I had helped some people. I mean, I'd had an opportunity to do it, and I had taken the opportunity to do it. I'd had a wonderful experience doing it, and really made a difference in some people's lives. And I only tell you that to tell you the second part of the story. I mean, Connie and I are going to this Vanderbilt basketball game, and we're driving over, and we're late because I was late. Traffic's bad. We're pulling in, and somebody made what I deemed to be an inappropriate lane change in front of me. And I wheeled up. I MF'd him. I flipped him off. I started screaming at him until we just started laughing at me. And we're going to the ball game, and we were talking about it later. And I said, you know, if you ask those people I was with earlier today, said, tell me about Steve Lee. Man, you would have gotten a glowing report. And if you'd have found that guy in that car, what do you think about that guy over there? And he would have had it. He would have that SOB. And they're both right about me. They're both right. And I'm capable of that and everything in between. And this emotional sobriety, this trying to find my spiritual balance is about trying to stay a little, keep the meter a little bit over on the 30-40% to the good side, I hope. And less of those flare-ups of that, because that's not, I don't do that, you know, three times a week, but I sure did it then. So I know I'm capable. And I don't want to just, so now I know that people, you know, that I'm more well-rounded than either of those incidents seem to indicate. The other thing that we talked about, and I've discovered that my problem is really never my problem. The story about the executive that wet his pants, I think, falls into that category. He didn't have a wet my pants problem. He had an I'm embarrassed problem. He had a self-centered problem. And I said, my problem is not my problem. My problem is that my problem is a problem. My problem is that I've identified something as problematic. I'm the guy in charge of labeling something a problem. And once I have labeled something a problem, have you ever, speaking of emotional sobriety, have you ever gotten up and gone out into the day as if it were a problem to solve? I certainly have. I have walked out into the day with an attitude that I'm just going to be swinging at windmills all day long. And by the way, that seems to be a pretty self-fulfilling prophecy when I look that way. So I think somebody mentioned it earlier. I went to not this specific example, but the kind of the principle behind it of not being held hostage to the external activities in life. I went to a meeting one night and I was sitting there and both the seats on both sides of me were vacant as people were coming in. But that probably says something about me that I'm the last two guys in the room are going to be the ones taking that seat probably. But, you know, a guy sits down next to me and people had heard Connie and I had been going through some financial challenges, or we had identified them as such for quite a while. And this guy sat down next to me and he said, Steve, how you doing, man? And I said, I am doing great. I said, thank you for asking. I mean, I've had one of those days where I was centered and in balance and in the flow as I'd had in a long time. And I said, I'm doing great, man. Thank you for asking. And the guy came, sat down on my right. He said, Steve, how's it going, man? I said, oh, it's not going worth a shit. I said, I talked about a couple of things. And this guy, the guy on my left, looks at me like I got two heads, you know? And he's looking at me like that. I said, look, I said, you asked me how I'm doing. And he asked me how it's going. And those are two different questions. And on a good day, they can have different answers. But far too often, how I'm doing is contingent upon my view of how it's going. And if that's the case, then I'm never going to be truly free. I'm always going to be captive to those particular dependencies. And believe me, they still hang around, and the severity of them ebbs and flows sometimes. But we do not have to be the many women in Alcoholics Anonymous told me when I showed up that my physical sobriety need not be conditional. There was not a page of drinking exceptions in the big book. If this happens, or if this happens, or if this happens, well, certainly you got to drink. We understand that it is unconditional. I can stay. It's a design for living that works in rough going. But you have also told me that my emotional sobriety it's a perfect ideal, but it can be unconditional. It is never going to be. That is the human aspect of me. That's why I'm so grateful how it works, is that none of us comes anywhere near perfect adherence to these principles. But within perfect adherence, I am not emotionally knocked off balance. The 10th step would suggest in the 12 and 12, when I land at the 10th step, it says that it's the acid test. This is the acid test of me now going out in life. It says, can I stay sober? Can I stay in emotional balance? And can I live to good purpose under all conditions? And the answer is, I've been 100% sober since June the 29th of 1989. My emotional balance has ebbed and flowed dramatically. And my effectiveness and usefulness seems to be somehow attached to that emotional stability or sobriety as well. But anyway, that's, we're here to get this whole new set of ideas, motives, and conceptions. That's what this psychic change that's being promised, that is necessary for my recovery, an entire psychic change where I can do, see, and believe things I cannot do, see, and believe on the unaided will and resources alone. I have a profound alteration in my reaction to life. So life begins right now. Life is just a little bigger. I'm going to tell this story, and I'll tell you guys who are on here, you already know, I'll tell you the two most often told lies in Alcoholics Anonymous from the podium. The first is, I'll be brief. And the other is, I'll close with this. So if you hear those in your home group, if you hear it from me, strap in. We got a little while to go. But a few years ago, I went out to eat. It was actually 13 years ago. I was in Toronto, and little men's retreat I was at, and we break to go to lunch. When we're broke for lunch, there's 10 of us sitting around this table ordering lunch at this restaurant, and they came to me and I ordered a cheeseburger. And the guy next to me ordered a club sandwich. I noticed it. I heard him order, and he went around. I wasn't paying attention to everything else, but I didn't know this guy well, but I heard his order. And they came back a little bit later and they gave me a cheeseburger, and they gave the guy next to me a cheeseburger. And he starts eating this cheeseburger, and I stopped him. I said, "Hey man, I said, I thought you ordered a club sandwich." And this is your Zen moment for the day. If you've been waiting on it, this is it. I said, "Man, I thought you ordered a club sandwich." And listen to what he said. This is remarkable. He said, "I did, Steve, but they brought me a cheeseburger." I said, "Brother, you don't have to live like that. We can get you a club sandwich." And I stand up. I'm calling people over. I'm trying to get management. And he's grabbed me. He said, "No, Steve." He said, "Man, and understand, he wasn't just eating the damn old cheeseburger, because that's what life served him. He was perfectly okay with the cheeseburger. Now, it would have been all right. This isn't a codependent thing. It would have been perfectly all right for him to have said, "You know what, ma'am, I ordered a club sandwich." Oh, she'd have said, "I'm sorry." And she would have gone and got a club sandwich. It had taken 10 minutes or so. But wasn't his life better because he was okay with the cheeseburger? And what I tell you is, I go through life, metaphorically speaking, ordering a club sandwich and getting a cheeseburger, and it ain't okay. I go through life unknowingly waiting for the world to get my order right. And I haven't even placed my order. I go through life expecting each of you. I look at this Hollywood Squares, and I've got certain requirements for all of you. And I don't even know I have them. I just know that you won't meet up to them. I need some of you to pay more attention. I need your lighting better on a couple of these squares, just so you don't look like you're in the witness protection program. I need a couple of you to chew with your mouth closed. Just stuff like that. But I go through and I have these requirements. And again, what they do is just put me in a corner. I paint myself into my own corner by my own demands. And the 12 and 12 says this isn't a life of having our demands met. It's a life of limiting our demands. And so with that, I'll throw it back over to June to take us to the end of the hour.
Okay, thanks. One of the things I was thinking about, I have a friend and they shared in a meeting and they were sharing about their life before they ever drank. And he was saying in high school, he was actually very popular. He was a member of the band. He actually became valedictorian of his class. He was chosen as the representative from his school to go to Washington, D.C. and have this special trip, during high school. And he had a lot of wonderful, amazing things happening in his life. And he said, but he never was able to enjoy or appreciate any of these wonderful things that were happening because he was always so busy looking at what you were getting, what other people were getting, what was happening to them, what did they get, what did they, And I've thought about that many times since he shared, because sadly, I've done that many times in my sobriety, where I've been more focused on what are you getting and worrying about what I'm not getting than really being able to enjoy and appreciate, what I'm having. When I was one of the, over the many times that I was sent to Chuck C, I was just going to tell you some of these things that he used to say. And he didn't just say them to me. He said them to everybody all the time. And they meant nothing to me, as I said, in those early years. And yet they are some of the things that mean the most to me on a recurring basis many, many years later. So one of the things that happened was, like I said, I was sent to him because I was illegally in the country. I had other court cases that were just going on. I was facing a court case with becoming a ward of the state because I was underage, sober, living on my own. And I didn't have any place to live. I had a seventh grade education. I had no relationship, like I said, with my family. I had no money and no place to live. So I felt that these were some difficult circumstances. And my sponsor obviously did too, because she sent me over to Chuck. And I was feeling kind of suicidal because as I mentioned, that was my first obsession. And I didn't give that up immediately on getting sober. It was sort of my hold card. I had to have a backup plan. And I really got from the old timers, thankfully, that I could never drink again, that this was a progressive disease that would only get worse. And I really, really believed that. And I have not ever doubted that. But I did think that if it didn't all work out, I would kill myself if I couldn't get this AA thing to work out. So I'm sitting there with Chuck and I tell him all of these issues that are going on. And Chuck says to me, "You are already everything you're ever going to be, and you have everything already that you're ever going to need." And again, it's one of those, I have to repeat all of these problems again, because clearly he must not have been listening or he wasn't focusing on the right issues here. But the truth is that years later, as we read, and learn and study different spiritual wisdom teachers in and out of the programs that we are in, we find that that is always the message that they are saying, that we don't need anything from the outside, that it's really all about getting rid of and clearing out. And so Chuck would also say, he said, we uncover, discover, and then we discard. It's clearing out so that we can become more and more who we are. Another thing that, that he used to say is he'd say, everyone's doing the best that they can. And if they knew better, they would do better. But at any given time, everyone is doing the best that they can. Now, I have trouble believing that sometimes because I can see people and I'm sure that they are not doing the best that I think that they can. And yet, if I get back to believing that, if I could believe that, which I have to pretend sometimes, but if I could believe that, it does help me have a lot more compassion for others as I watch things that are going on. It also has helped me have compassion for myself, for the mistakes that I have made or the things that I have said or done that at the time I felt that they were the right thing to do. And I can look back now and see that maybe they weren't. But I was trying to act, you know, from that good place. Another one of the things that Chuck would talk about was he would say, when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. And one of the things that I have asked probably the most often over the years is I've asked for myself to become a willing student so that I can find my teacher. And I'm not always a willing student, you know, and I have wished that for others, including my kids, as I said, because I think that sometimes they are able to get their teachers are others than I, you know, and I want them to find those teachers. Another one of the things that he would talk about is you can't plant carrots and get green beans. And I would think, what in the world are we talking about gardening here? I can't pay my rent. You know what I mean? It's like, this is so irrelevant. But the longer I stay sober, and of course, you know, I'm sure we can get back to biblical, you know, quotes as well, of which I'm not very good at. But this idea that we do get, you know, that we get what we're planting. So that sometimes, as the book talks about, you know, our problems are frequently of our own making. And so we can't keep planting carrots or making a problem situation for ourselves over and over again, expecting it to be different, expecting to get something different from it. And one of the other things that he shared about that became very important to me later on, and continues to be over the years, was Chuck would say, if you go to work Monday through Friday just to get your paycheck and to have the weekend off, then you are cheating yourself and everyone that you come into contact with. And I would think, well, what does that mean? Because we all know that, you know, anything to do with a job, it's all about a paycheck. I mean, whoever has the best paycheck has the best job. I mean, I was sure of that. And he would say, if you go to work Monday through Friday just to get a paycheck and to have the weekend off, you're cheating yourself and everyone that you come into contact with. Because Monday through Friday, while you're at this job, you're miserable. And maybe on Saturday, you can have a little bit of fun. But on Sunday, that organ grind, that sausage grinder starts going in your stomach because you know you got to go back to that job that you don't like to get that paycheck that you need to do the job that you don't like so that you can have that Saturday off. And so, you know, again, it didn't really mean anything to me for a long, long time. I mean, I was over 10 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous before I could afford to put a dollar in the basket at the Seventh Tradition. So I was not quickly going to, you know, to make money or be able to be financially self-supporting in sobriety for a long, long time. And quite honestly, I haven't always been able to put a dollar or two in the basket since I was 10 years sober, you know. But one of the things that happened for me was when I had gone back to school and I was waitressing, I didn't ever want to be a waitress, but I was. And as I'm sure all of you know, that at least in California, and I think most places, when you're waitressing, most of the money that you get really comes from tips. I mean, they were basically paying me, I think, like a dollar an hour or something. It was kind of crazy. And so the only money that you're going to get is your tips. And so, you know, during my little breaks or after I would serve the people, I would come back into the back of the restaurant and I would count my tips to see, am I going to have enough money to make my rent? Am I going to have enough, you know, money to buy food? Am I going to have enough money, you know, whatever it was. And I would just count them frantically and I go, oh my God, I'm not going to make it. And, you know, whatever. And then I'd go back out there to be my waitress. And, you know, there's always someone and they want extra ice. I don't know why they can't ask for extra ice in the beginning. So now I got to give them extra ice. And someone else is like, can I have some mustard? And, you know, like the mustard's already on the table, but they, you know, they want the mustard. And like, miss. And, you know, this whole thing and the water's too hot and they want an extra lemon and a, you know, blah, blah, blah. And it's very annoying. And I'm sort of doing all this and slamming all this stuff around, giving them their extra ice and giving them their lemon. And I go back there and I'm in the back and I start thinking about Chuck talking about being of service, about helping God's kids do what they need to have done because I want to. And I just started thinking in this way, and this may sound very new age, you know, California to you, and that's okay. But, you know, it's the way that I began to think. And I thought, you know, that person, she needs extra ice because she's actually a surgeon. And she's going back in there to do surgery right after she finishes this lunch that I'm giving her. And she needs a little extra ice so that she can stay awake, so that she can function and do a good job. And that guy over there that needs the extra mustard, he's a construction worker, and he's working on that extra unit at the hospital. He's building that extra surgery center. Do you know what I mean? And I just began to see us all as being really connected, and that my job was just for them, for that particular day, was just to bring extra ice and get someone an extra lemon and allow them to have this food and drink so that they can go ahead and be of service in the way that they were needed to be of service. And it was like my tips got better. You know, it was really remarkable. Now, I know, of course, that part of that had to do with my attitude. You know what I mean? I wasn't slamming the ice on the table because I was totally annoyed. Instead, I was trying to offer the ice to someone in the hopes that they might have a better day. And that gets us back to, again, that attitude thing. You know, another one of the old timers, you know, that I just adored would talk about this shift that we work on. And again, it is an exercise, not something that I have certainly achieved on a regular basis, but I have to remember almost on a daily basis of doing that shift from I get to, you know, from I've got to I get to. So every morning I go to the beach with my dog who, you know, wants to play Frisbee and go to the bathroom. Some days I do it because I have to get the dog and I have to hurry up and get back and I've got other things to do and I hope she's going to hurry up and I hope I don't have to throw the Frisbee for too long. I hope it's, you know, whatever. And other mornings I go out there and I'm like, I get to go to the beach. I mean, this is fantastic. And my dog is so happy. If I could have an attitude like my dog, when we get to the beach, it is as if she has never seen the beach before. And she gets to play Frisbee. It's unbelievable, you know. And I see that and I know that some days I feel like that too. You know, some days I really see how very overpaid and joyous, you know, I am to have this, you know, this life that I have, to have that relief, you know, from the bondage of self, to really feel like I am useful and that I do have a lot to offer. You know, most importantly, ultimately, this transformation allowed me to get to a point where I don't want to trade places with anybody. This is absolutely unbelievable to me. You know, it's beyond that I don't want to look like anybody else or don't want to be living their life, be married to their person or have their mother or any of those things. It's this feeling inside, you know what I mean, where I don't want to trade places. And I have some rough things going on in my life. And I have had some bumps in my life during the years that I have been sober. And I do them all again to be able to be living the life that I get to live because of everything that I have learned from Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, I remember Steve saying, I don't remember exactly what it was, but, you know, he was mentioning about that spark, you know, and I believe that this spiritual awakening, you know, that again, that it is an awakening that happens for us, that people are adding light and they are helping us wake up and helping us have a bigger experience. And I think that that's part of what's important about the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I can't even tell you how thrilled I am about the Zoom, you know, format and the fact that I've had I've been going to meetings in all these different countries, you know, and hearing the language of the heart with different accents. It's absolutely fantastic, you know, and I really encourage you, you know, to take that opportunity, you know, to go to some of these different countries and, you know, just look it up and just show up at the meeting. I mean, it has added so much. I remember the first international that I went to, and I got to meet Lois Wilson, you know, at that international. The topic, you know, the theme of the conference in 1975 in Denver was Let It Begin With Me. And at that time, Alcoholics Anonymous was smaller and the convention was smaller than it is today. But they had the flag bearer from every country walk up to the state, up to the front of the stadium and say in their native language, Let It Begin With Me. You know, and we were all crying before the second person, you know, had introduced themselves as we heard these different accents and languages and that idea, you know, of letting it begin with me so that we can add something. Anyway, back to you, Steve. I don't know where we are on the break thing.
We're going to break in just a second. I want to comment on two things you said. In fact, let me share with the crowd that I'll be brief and I'll end with this. But but the you just said two things that I didn't want to forget to comment on, June, and one of them was about work. And I think it falls right into this, into our topic today. And about 8 years ago, I had worked all my life in a family business and then made a change and went to work for a bigger company, and that had a lot of the structure in place that our little entrepreneurial enterprise had never had. And one of those things was using Salesforce, which some of you've probably heard of, but it basically included going in every day and logging my activities. And it also showed everyone's productivity. And I would go in at night to put my stuff in, but I would also look at the people on my team. I'm in the Southeastern regional team, and I was not doing all that great. And I found myself beginning to hope that they were doing poorly. You know, when you're struggling, so I found myself going and looking at those numbers and hoping that they were equally bad, if not worse. And that was so uncomfortable to me, and I was so discouraged by that, you know. But I actually composed a prayer, because see what I need in this deal. I need power I don't have to do stuff I can't do. And so I want to invite God into this, because that's a lot, you know, one of the last places I'm bringing him in is in money and work. And the prayer goes like this. It says, as I go about my job today, help me suit up and show up. Do what is next. Work humbly today with no fear of tomorrow. Help me remember that my real job is to serve you and my fellows. Help me be guided by spiritual principles rather than fear or scarcity. Help me treat coworkers and other providers not as competition, but as fellow travelers, asking myself, how can I help this man or woman? My job is not to be better than them. My job is to be better than me. Help me that I might look upon this job as a way to make a difference rather than simply make a living. And doing that really changed my attitude going into the day. It was a profound alteration in my reaction to life. So that's an area in which I had to bring this emotional sobriety into the workplace. The other thing that June said, that Chuck C said, and see, I will never get to tell you what Chuck C said to me, but I love listening to June's stories, and I love the Sybil stories. Today's maybe not today, but I sure love those. But it struck me a while back, at least in my case, saying that when the student's ready, the teacher will appear. I 100% believe that is true, 100% of the time. And I believe it because it's been my experience with me that when I'm the student, that whenever the student is ready, everybody's the teacher. When I am ready, it is almost invariably the person in front of me has something to offer me. But if my mind is closed, if fear is driving the boat, if those things, then I can't hear, I can't glean from someone what's there for me to learn from them. And there was a man who gave me a little locket a number of years ago, Jack G from Rhode Island. June, I don't know if you ever met Jack, but wonderful guy. And it had a little, these two grasping hands. And on it, it said, everybody needs help. And below it, it said, everybody can help. And the takeaway for me was that these helping hands here don't know which one is needing the help and which one, you know, we don't know who's getting and who's receiving. Because the truth is, it's a two-way street. It's never a one-way street. We'll take a break. Come back at 10 after 6. Thank God. Or that's 6 o'clock Central Time, by the way. So don't disappear for 2 hours. See you in 10 minutes.
Brian, you're muted. You're muted, Yvonne. You're muted.
Conversation here. Thank you, guys. I was saying that Chuck, what an honor that I get to hear them. And I don't think it all originated with Chuck C. I mean, there was other people that's whose shoulders he stands on. But I don't think Chuck was thinking, I'm going to tell June this story, because in 2020, they're going to have a pandemic. So they're going to talk about my stories on a freaking Zoom. And that is so beautiful. When I get into the program, you never know when you touch somebody else and when that is going to come back. And to listen to stories that help me today from people that are no longer here, it's like, you know, I can hear dead people. That movie just always fascinated me. And so I was talking to two people that just blow my mind from time to time. One of them said, you have to pray for the acceptance. And you have to pray so much that you don't only accept it, it's what you want. And I'm thinking, oh, hell no. Just accepting is good enough. I mean, if I can get there. And the other one says, you know, it's all about God's will. And I'm like, well, yeah. And it's like, well, you know what? Pray for God's will. And then find joy in God's will, even though it's not what you want. And I'm thinking, he's saying the same thing. And it's coming from a different person. And when I listened to the emotional sobriety, those two things were going through my head. How hard it is to accept God's will for me and to find joy in it. It's hard enough to get to acceptance sometimes for me, let alone joy. Diana, what you got in your bell ringer repertoire?
What? Actually, I found this interesting article in the Box 455. It's the newsletter from General Services in 1987. And I thought this was interesting. I am an alcoholic. Who said it first? Who was the first to start a meeting or a qualification with the statement, I am an alcoholic? How did the worldwide custom begin? As lay co-founder Bill W. used to observe, nobody invented AA. It just grew. Also probably did this classic introduction at meetings. Many members asked us these questions, says GSO archivist Frank M. Unfortunately, only a few of the early timers are left, and not many of them are able to provide plausible theories. So we can only speculate. According to an early friend of AA, the late Henrietta Cyberling, the expression dates back to meetings of AA's forerunner, the Oxford Group Movement, which had its heyday in the early 1930s. Miss Cyberling, a non-alcoholic who had sought spiritual help in the Oxford Group meetings, introduced Bill to AA's other co-founder, Dr. Bob, when struggling to get sober in the Oxford Group. At small meetings, the members knew one another and didn't need to identify themselves. But in the large public meetings, there was a witnessing along the lines of an AA talk today. Personal identification became necessary. Chances are that someone at some time, I am an alcoholic, but said, I am an alcoholic, but Mrs. Cyberling wasn't sure, nor did she remember that the phrase was used at early AA meetings in Akron before publication of the Big Book. In fact, she said, the word alcoholic was rarely uttered, at least in Akron. People referred to themselves as drunks, or rum hounds, or boozers, or other choice reminiscence of temperance movement that gained adherence to public prohibition. An early New York AA first heard the expression as, I am an alcoholic and my name is. According to his recollection, that was after World War II in 1945 or 46. And it is a matter of record that in 1947, a documentary film entitled, I Am an Alcoholic, was produced by RKO. From then on, as Bill might say, the custom just grew. Thank you, Yvonne. I like that. Never heard that before.
Diana, General Service, what was it? General Service Board newsletter? You're muted. Haha.
It's called Box 459, and it's news and notes from the General Service Office of AA. And this was the April-May issue of 1987.
Thank you. Love that. And I see Steve got himself
typed
like crazy here. That's what you get when you read something from paper. They want to have it in the text box. So the work prayer is now in the chat. If you want to copy it, you have to write it down. Is there anybody that wants to share anything? Is there anybody that would like to say something? Do you have any questions? No? Okay. I had some random questions. We don't do regular meetings. We only do conferences or workshops, a series. So you can only find us when we do a conference or a workshop series. Our flyers are on the website, at the same websites where you can listen to all the recordings and a gazillion other recordings from all sorts of other conferences or meetings. If you go to the three websites, you can find events. Recovery Tapers also has a subscription that you can take out. It's called Threads, where there's all sorts of big book studies, history stuff, the two-way prayer stuff, you name it, they've got it. So if you want more information on flyers, go to one of the three websites. When I get flyers from whomever sends them to me, we put them up. So if you want your flyer up, just send them to AWB and we'll put them up. Or you can send them to either one of the three tapers and they'll put them up. Evelyn.
Yes, I have a question. I know there was a situation with this these workshops.
Yeah,
and with the World Service Office, is this sanctioned by World Service? Can we mention it in our meetings? I was told that it's not, and we should not mention it to let the people know. What is the situation with that?
Well, no, we're not sanctioned. Currently, the World Service Office has no policy or structure in place to register any Zoom workshops or conferences.
Mm-hmm.
They will only register an Al-Anon Zoom meeting. So only when you're a Zoom meeting of an hour 15, hour and a half, you can register. If you're not, you are not a sanctioned, as people like to say that word, Al-Anon meeting. So although I would love to register, I would love to do, they won't let me. They can't register anybody in any state. So even if you have your state conference, for instance, you're still not a legal conference. That is something that they're working on. So whether you want to mention this or not in your meetings, we are not officially registered with Al-Anon. And I think the reason why AA does have their conferences, because we don't own our logo, we don't own the literature, we don't own any of those copyrights. All of that is owned by the World Service Office. So if you don't have their permission, you may not use none of that. AA does not have that particular problem. That's why you see a lot more AA conferences. I hope that satisfies your question.
Well, I just wasn't sure if we're allowed to mention this, because somebody said it was a break of tradition that I know. And so I didn't know if that was what the situation.
We don't mention outside issues in Al-Anon. We don't promote outside issues unless you're a official meeting.
Okay.
You won't be announced in meetings, but each meeting is autonomous. I can't register. They don't know. They don't have a system, policy, or anything for that. So
Okay. That's
all I know.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks. Thank you
for asking. Anybody else? Okay. Well. Yeah, I'm thinking about what's next. I don't know what's next. Does anybody have a what's next? No questions? You guys have no questions? Seriously? You do know that if you want an answer, you have to ask a question, right? If you don't ask the question, you never get the answer kind of thing? No?
I see Margaret and Al with their hands up.
Margaret and Al? Hold on. Oh, there. Okay, hold on now. I couldn't see you. There you go.
Okay, you unmuted me? Good. Thanks for the speakers. It's sort of like the old-timey stuff. I've been around for a long time and knew some of those persons and heard a lot of that stuff and still enjoy hearing it. A lot of good stuff there. For me, a lot of times I get that, wow, are you still going to those, after 36 years, you still go to AA meetings? And I go, yeah, it's part of my recovery. And I've heard a lot of words like recovery in here, which I always like. And for me, AA is part of my recovery. It's not my complete recovery. I have a lot of things I do besides AA, which is fine. Works for me. Whatever works for you, works for you. But, you know, and half of them will go like, what's recovery? And I always go, well, for me, it's that it's an endless, continuous journey of self-improvement. And if I'm doing that, if I'm doing those actions for me, you know, I cultivate those positive traits that edges out all those defects of character and stuff for me. And that sort of works. And I heard Diane was talking about that word happiness, which we don't hear a lot of times. We hear problems sometimes, or bottom line for me is happiness. And I'm not talking about Cadillac happiness or the best house happiness, that kind of, that's that inner stuff. And emotional sobriety for me came about through action. You know, that establishment of new behaviors, my brain needed rewired. Basically, and I had to get sober for anything to happen, and I got that through AA. And if there's any newcomers, when I came in, also I'm going to use Steve's line here. You know, I'll try to be brief, but back then it was, if you talked about going for outside help, it was a no-no. You talked about a psychiatrist, it was like, whoa, bud, this program will fix anything you have. Well, you might have PTSD, OCD, deep depression. If you need help, I think it was Kimmy was talking about her depression, please pursue outside help. This program doesn't cure all. You know, it's a great program for getting sober. But I just like to emphasize that some of us need extra stuff. But nothing happens if you're not sober. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Al. Margaret.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you so much for this workshop. I'm from Southern California. I am a GR and I am in Al-Anon side of the house. I just wanted to share, I did send an email to you, Yvonne, because I was asking this exact question about sharing about these workshops and our meetings. And I did call WSO and I talked to our group services there. They don't have a policy on this. This they with COVID for them. So, and they are aware. And but we can share outside our meeting. Are aware it might be of help with recovery. I cannot announce this in my meetings, but I do text and email these workshops outside of my meetings. So it's up to anyone in our members that be able to attend. And also for those that are on the call in our service manual on page 91 and 92, it addresses this and what we can announce. And there's a little blurb about the autonomy of service arms. Whether to announce a particular event is a matter of autonomy, keeping in mind that other groups, the district or area may have different criteria. But this paragraph here says, just as we have no opinion on outside literature, we have no opinion on events outside of Al-Anon. Members may read or attend whatever helps them in the recovery, but we keep our events focused on Al-Anon principles and topics. So with that, I've been felt very free about sharing this with any of my members outside of my meeting, and that was confirmed with me by our World Service office. So I just wanted to share that. I didn't know if anybody said that, but I wanted to say that.
Thank you, Margaret.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, Steve, I'm going to go back to you.
Thank you, Yvonne. All right, everybody, Steve Lee, alcoholic, and we are on the home stretch. I got to tell you, some of you guys have actually been here, started with Stephanie. I can't believe that you have the stamina that you have exhibited today. And I hope that some of you just actually have a little TV screen below this screen and the volume down and are watching something else. This kind of held your attention, but I'm grateful for the company. And I'm just going to take about 10 minutes or so here and kind of make a few last points for me. And I'm sure that June will do the same. And then again, if there are questions and stuff, we'll hang around. Certainly I will, as long as you guys want afterwards. But I don't want to just feel like we have to run you all the way to the bell. It's you've been remarkably patient. But, you know, one of the things that that I've noticed, and I talked earlier about the difference in information and transformation. And I think Al mentioned it and some others mentioned it. And we can't read and pray and good intention ourselves into spiritual growth. It is a component, but it requires, at least in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I think in any 12-step program, continuous action, a commitment to the actions embodied in the principles that we're taking. And I said, we take the information and put it into application to bring about the transformation. And Bill, in this writing on emotional sobriety, he makes the point, or kind of as one of the challenges, is how to take how to translate a right mental conviction into a right emotional result. You know, by your very presence here today, you know, for the most part, we are all preaching to the choir. And just by being here, you are people who are already exhibiting a commitment to your recovery and the activity of recovery. But how do I take this information? And that's one of the things that I struggled with, and it can show up anytime, but I recognize it today. It's less a struggle as more of an observation, but that I have information that does not comfort me. So I know more about my problem than I have ever known. And I know more about the solution than I have ever known. But there are times that I don't feel like I'm having the experience. I have the knowledge. And sometimes I even feel like I'm chopping wood and carrying water, but am not having the experience that is being talked about. So there is something, I think, about how do I take this right mental conviction. Since I have been in Alcoholics Anonymous, I have never, since at least early 1990, a year into my recovery, I have never once doubted that Alcoholics Anonymous is where I both need to be and where I want to be. But my surrender to the solution of AA has ebbed and flowed during that time, not consciously, not typically conscious rebellion, but I have, I don't know about any of you guys, I have fallen into middle management in AA. I've fallen into that trap. Have you ever been a middle manager? That's where you put people together. Somebody asks you to sponsor them and I introduce them to somebody. Somebody asked I was sitting around with guys I sponsor one night. This had been a few years ago, and we were given a quiz and we were talking about service. And somebody said, Steve, what have you done in service? And I listed off, you know, it was a resume that, you know, included, you know, all the normal service positions in our, you know, group, district, and area, been GSR, been public information, been correctional facilities chair. You know, been a DCM and one of the guys, and I rattled it off with pretty proud, and the guy said, well, when was that? And it was over 10 years since I'd held any of those positions, you know. So I was playing, I was on my resume. And so I have to see, am I in the game? Or have I become a commentator? One of the things that I have to guard against as a person who's been asked to have these conversations, actually, that's not true. We haven't had a conversation, have we? We've had a monologue, not a dialogue. And in a monologue, I find myself, I am now a commentator about Alcoholics Anonymous, and which is just one step away from spectator. But am I a participant in the game? And that's a question that I have to ask myself, because that's where my emotional sobriety is going to come from. I'll tell you a story to wrap up with. And Howard Polins was mentioned earlier today, and Howard was such a remarkable guy and such a true character. And Howard, as many of you know, used to regularly tell a story about walking across a frozen lake, and he even ended up writing a book called My Life on a Frozen Lake. And the story behind that walk on a frozen lake is, and I am paraphrasing it, and Howard told the story much better, but the premise around that story is about how we and a guy like me can live life like a guy walking across a frozen lake, afraid with every step that the ice is not going to hold, it's going to crack, he's going to fall and drown. And what a tedious, anxiety-filled life that would be. And I told Howard that I had taken his story and improved upon it. And he never believed that, but Howard's past, he's not here to defend himself. And in my version of the story, I told Howard, I said, there are two men getting ready to walk across the frozen lake in my story, Howard. One, afraid with every step that the ice is going to crack and he's going to fall and drown. The other, absolutely confident that the ice is going to hold him. And they take off on their stroll across the frozen lake together. And halfway across the lake, sure enough, the ice breaks, they fall through, and they both drown. But the guy who thought the ice was going to hold him had a much nicer walk up until then. And I don't know what's going to happen, but I want to enjoy the walk. I don't want to be living this life. And somebody, I think June spoke about it when she talked about work and looking at those 5 days as something I have to do to get to these 2 days of the weekend. And I tell you how much of my life I've spent getting ready to have a good day in preparation for a good, I remember 97, we almost got there. And, you know, we're always in preparation as soon as something happens. So the last story, I'll end with this. There's a Sufi story, and with my accent, I've never felt comfortable telling a Sufi story. So I've changed the participants to Tennessee rednecks. And in this story, there's an old boy who's out in the front yard. He's lost the keys to his pickup truck, and he's crawling around looking for the keys to his truck. And a couple of his buddies drive by and they see that he's down there, and they stop and ask what's going on. And he explains to them he's lost the keys to his truck, and his good friends are want to do. They get out and begin to help him look for the keys. And now there are three of them crawling around on their hands and knees in this grass. And before you know it, you've got 7 or 8, then 10 guys crawling around looking for the keys to this truck, till finally one of them asked him, they said, "Where were you when you lost the keys?" And he said, "Oh, I was in the house." And they said, "Well, what are we doing out here?" And he said, "Well, the light's so much better out here." And what I will tell you is I spend an awful lot of time looking out here. And if you happen by, I will explain my problem to you and you will stop and help me look. But in truth, the keys are always inside. The keys to the kingdom, the key to my emotional sobriety, the key to my peace of mind, are always internal. And you have taught me to quit looking out here for the solution to my problem, but to go inside, to connect with that power greater than myself, that divine spark that we've spoken of. And in that moment, in those moments, I have that sense of peace. I am emotionally stable. I am in balance with that. And it is directly contingent upon or proportionate to that connection. Unfortunately, I'm like that bad lamp in your house that blinks on and off. My connection is not stable. Many times a day, I'm going to be connected and disconnected. But when I'm connected, I can feel the difference. Our book says, what is this spiritual experience? It is my ability to do, feel, and believe that which I cannot do on my unaided will or resources alone. So I'll end where Bill did. We've spent 4 hours here, 3.5. And as Bill said in his deal, I hadn't told you anything new. Few tricks. There's nothing that we've shared with you you didn't know already. We may have said it in a different story. We may have come from a different point of view. But in truth, there's been no new information here. We are just trying to take that right mental conviction and get to a right emotional result. I sure love that you guys were willing to have us here today, and I love that June was willing to spend this time with me, and I will let her finish out our time together. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. You know, I have a couple little things that I want to go ahead and close up with. You know, one of them is that I happen to be very rigid in my thinking, believe it or not. I don't think of myself as being, you know, rigid sometimes. But in truth, I have to watch out for that. And I read this story, and I'm sure some of you may have heard about it or read it as well. But it's a story about there was a group at an ashram in India that would meditate with this very famous teacher of meditation. But the teacher, he had a cat, and the cat would wander through and kind of knock into everybody and sort of paw at them and lay on their lap. And he was very distracting while they were meditating. And so it became the practice that when there was time for them to meditate with this great teacher, they would tie the cat, not in a painful way, but they would tie the cat so that the cat wouldn't bother everybody, so they could do the meditation. When the meditation was over, they would let the cat go. And then one day the cat died. And so they stopped, they couldn't meditate anymore. And if that doesn't make sense, what I'm saying is that they got so used to the routine that you had to tie the cat, that once they didn't have a cat to tie, they thought they couldn't go forward with the meditation. And that is sometimes how I look at things in my life or in the world. And I think it's been really important for me, part of staying close to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, so that I can hear people share about doing things in a different way. It's not necessarily a right or a wrong way to change things up or to do something differently, but to expand and allow. So I wanted to read you again something from the family afterward. We have been speaking to you of serious, sometimes tragic things. We've been dealing with alcohol in its worst aspect, but we aren't a glum lot. If newcomers could see no joy or fun in our existence, they wouldn't want it. We absolutely insist on enjoying life. We try not to indulge in cynicism over the state of the nation, nor do we carry the world's troubles on our shoulders. And I thought about that line a lot, you know, with all the events that are going on, you know, in the country and in the world. And it's been important for me to remember that. So we think cheerfulness and laughter make for usefulness. Outsiders are sometimes shocked when we burst into merriment over a seemingly tragic experience out of the past. But why shouldn't we laugh? We have recovered, and we have been given the power to help others. We are sure God wants us to be happy, joyous, and free. We cannot subscribe to the belief that this life is a vale of tears, though it once was just that for many of us. But it is clear that we made our own misery. God didn't do it. Avoid then the deliberate manufacture of misery. And that is something that when I'm working with people, I'm trying to remind them to stop manufacturing extra misery. You know, the last thing I wanted to read is something I stole from a friend of mine who's been reading it when he's been speaking the last few weeks. I told him I'd be stealing it. He doesn't need credit now that he knows that I have already confessed to doing that. It's also from The Language of the Heart. And it's a story or, you know, an article called The Greatest Gift of All. The greatest gift that can come to anybody is a spiritual awakening. Without doubt, this would be the certain verdict of every well-recovered alcoholic in AA's entire fellowship. So then what is this spiritual awakening, this transforming experience? How can we receive it, and what does it do? To begin with, a spiritual awakening is our means of finding sobriety. And to us of AA, sobriety means life itself. We know that a spiritual experience is the key to survival from alcoholism, and that for most of us, it is the only key. We must awake or we die. So we do awake and we are sober. Then what? Is sobriety all that we are to expect of a spiritual awakening? Again, the voice of AA speaks up. No, sobriety is only a bare beginning. It is only the first gift of the first awakening. If more gifts are to be received, our awakening has to go on. And it does, and if it does go on, we find that bit by bit, and as my friend pointed out, it's bit by bit, not leap by leap, you know, or big event by big event, bit by bit, we can discard the old life, the one that did not work, for a new life that can and does work under any conditions whatever, regardless of worldly success or failure, regardless of pain or joy, regardless of sickness or health, or even of death itself, a new life of endless possibilities can be lived if we are willing to continue our awakening. And the one other line I'd like to point out that's part of chapter 5 that we read at least in all AA meetings, and I assume it's read sometimes in Al-Anon meetings perhaps, or when you're studying the book. But at the end of, near the end of chapter 5, the part that we read, there's that line that says, "Do not be discouraged." So please, I encourage you to continue to go to meetings, to continue to improve on your emotional sobriety and passing on what you learned. Thank you for letting us be a part of your day. And I'm going to stop and we'll see whether there's questions or whether we're all going home to eat an early dinner or whichever.
Thank you, guys. If you want to unmute and give them a hand so they can hear you, you can do that. Yes, you now have.
Yay!
Thank you.
Guys, were wonderful.
That was fantastic. Awesome. Thank you.
So much.
Amazing. Yeah, if a couple of you want to hang out and you want to chit chat, feel free. Not all at the same time. And if you're not talking, please put the mute back on. We do not need to hear your background noise. Feel free. I appreciate you guys. I love that you're a good combination. You're good together. Mm-hmm.
You guys are marathoners, man. Y'all are a brutal group. I can promise you, June and I wouldn't pay a union scale to listen to each other talk. So,
you know, say that you don't say anything new, but sometimes it depends how it's said that I can hear it. There's people that say things to me, I can't hear them. And I definitely could not hear the language of the heart when I came in. I was way too PO'd and angry and all of that. I couldn't hear anything soft. If it wasn't loud and obnoxious, I couldn't hear it. So yeah, I've came a long way. I can hear language of the heart now. I had to learn. Thank you so much.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be how they say it. It's how we hear it, right?
That too.
I'm Debbie. I also wanted to say, I understand that thing. You lay this problem out so well to a sponsor, and they don't seem to understand because they keep talking about this or that, you know, and I got my sponsor one day. I knew what she was going to say because she, well, did you pray about it? And I knew that was coming, so I called her up, and I went, blah, 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 and she went, did you pray about it? I said, yes, I did, and he told me to call you. So I've gotten over that a little bit, you know, but it's just, it's so fun to have those little memories and know other people are out there going, I don't know what she's talking about, but I think there might be a solution somewhere, you know? And Steve, I wanted to say my husband that's been kind of coming in and out. You guys went out and ate pizza one time at Crested Butte. So it is good to see you again.
Well, good.
Yeah, bye.
Thank you, Debbie. Anybody else?
All right, well, I'm going to take Finnegan back to the beach pretty soon. It's time for her Frisbee again.
Oh, boy.
Well, I've seen the lineup you guys have over the next few weeks, and you've got some terrific people coming in here to clean up our mess. It's a good thing that they're here to plug the holes in the boat.
Sorry, Luther got, he's my year. We both got sober in 1972. That'll be great.
I love Luther.
Will it be the same codes next week, Yvonne, or will it be different?
Okay. No, the codes are staying the same, whether we do conference or workshops, we got the same code.
Okay.
And I spent the weekend with Luther years ago. It's called a solution weekend. It was emotional sobriety. For 5 years, they had him every year, and Luther was one of those speakers. And I thought, who is this? And I always remembered Luther, and I'm thinking, we're going to get Luther because I love his stories. Yeah.
He's fantastic. Oh, I think you've got a hand.
Yeah. He's cute. All right. Anybody else wants to say thank you? Or
I think Evelyn has a hand up.
Evelyn, you can unmute yourself. Go ahead.
Yes. I came in a little late. What was that last reading, June, about the spiritual awakening? Where did that come from?
From the language of the heart. At least that's, you know, I'm sure you can find it other places. It's called The Greatest Gift of All. It's one of Bill's writings.
And is Language of the Heart an AA book?
It is, but you know, so many things now we can find out just on Google by just the, you know, the title. I don't know for sure. I think it's from a Grapevine article, The Greatest Gift of All, and it was in 1957, December 1957.
Great, thank you so much, and thank you for your sharing.
Sure, thanks.
Yeah. If I'm not mistaken, Language of the Heart is about emotional sobriety, right? Is that essay of Bill in there also? Because I don't.
Yeah.
Yes, it is,
yes.
Isn't it? I figured.
It is all of Bill's writings for the Grapevine over the years.
So if you want to read more of his great writings, look at Language of the Heart. It's an AA book. If you want to learn an essay about leadership, look at Concept 9 in the Al-Anon Service Manual.
Thanks, sweetheart.
That sounds great.
Yeah, guys, say thank you to Billy, who runs the platform for us, and Jim.
Hey, Billy.
Awesome.
Hey, Billy.
Her dad.
Thank you, Billy.
Thank you, Billy.
Thank you, Billy. Thank you, Jim.
And you got my buddy Joe over there in the Amott Square, right, doing the recording.
And Amott Audio does the recording for the American language. They ship all the recordings, so only one has to record the audio. But Jim from Amott, I know he's hiding behind his A, did the American Sign Language. So you guys will be in American Sign Language, both for Al-Anon and AA. So it's the gift that keeps on giving, like listening to Chuck C's stories.
My sponsor was sponsored by Chuck for 15 years, so my sponsor has 53 years, but, you know, we had.
Oh, my. Oh, my. Yeah.
Hey, well, can I jump in there real quick? Was it Al that said he did a Language of the Heart book study?
No, it was Billy.
Is that a workbook, work study? Is that available online? Can I find it? Okay.
There's
great.
Several of them going on right now. If you'll start asking around, somebody will bump you into one. Okay.
Well, you can start your own. Get a group of people, get a book, and start reading through it. Right?
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Zoom, Steve, if you want to go, you're free to go. Those who want to hang for a minute can hang.
I think I am going to take off. Thank you again for letting us be a part of it. Steve, I'll talk to you later.
June, when that phone rings tonight from our sponsee, I expect you to respond appropriately. I'm going to check with him. I love you, June. I love you guys. Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you. I'm going to let Connie know you gave me 30.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
Bye, Billy.
All right.
Another question.
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead.
Me, Simone? Okay. So, Yvonne, I was just curious about the recording for today. Will the entire session be available for listening to, or just the speaker part?
No, the entire session.
Yeah, okay. Great, cool. Thank you.
Evelyn?
And what is that work, that website to hear get the recordings?
We'll put it in the chat. It's amotaudio.com, amot, A-M-O-T, audio.com, msbrecording.com. He's putting it in the chat.
Oh, great.
And recoverytapers.com. They all maneuver a little bit different, so whatever website is easier to maneuver around in is where you can go.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for being here.
And thank you for all your service, Yvonne. Great job, thank you.
They also have the flyers, and they have, of course, our flyer is also there if you're wondering. And pass it along to your friends in AA or whomever needs to be here. Thank you, guys. Anne, it's good seeing you. I'm gonna say good night.
Love you, Yvonne.
Love you too. Bye, Simone. Nice meeting you.
Bye. Yeah, good seeing you.
Recording.com.
Bye. Bye, Diana.
And recovery.
All right. I'm gonna leave.
Thank you, Yvonne.